John Betts with Malcolm Honlein, and we're very pleased to welcome Michael Knight, the Jill and Jay Bernstein Fellow at the Washington Institute, to help us understand what we know, what we're learning about the risk of what is called a ground offensive. Within these hours, this headline from Israel: IDF tanks, troops push into Gaza in limited raid ahead of ground offensive. Military says it struck, goes the subhead. Hamas cites operatives in hours-long targeted raid before returning infantry to Israeli side of border. Michael, a very good evening to you. A raid, reminding me of the raids in the frozen front lines of the first war. What would a raid accomplish? What can we learn from this raid? Good evening to you.
Good evening. Thanks for having me. Well, I think one of the key things that the Israelis are doing, and the US has probably had a little bit of impact on this, is to slow down and stretch out their plans, including how to begin this operation. I think there was probably a recognition during President Biden's visit to Israel that the Israeli Defense Forces were not working off of a particularly complicated plan for a major incursion into Gaza. And so there was an encouragement to slow things down, to break the operation into a number of smaller phases, and we're beginning to see the first phase now.
Do you believe that Hamas had the expectation to be able to have the initial thrust to capture so many hostages? Is there really room for them to negotiate, or are they just stalling for time and, you know, reveling in their victory?
Well, I think Hamas experienced what is sometimes called catastrophic success, meaning that they didn't expect the raid to be so successful, and they didn't expect the raid to be so atrocious, I would expect. I think a large number of non-trained fighters came into Israel alongside the commandos that we now hear were partially trained in Iran. And I think, you know, that created a degree of uncontrollability about the operation. And that meant that we had more outrageous actions. We have Israel that is more enraged, and we have a United States that's more enraged. So, you know, what they were counting on was being able to deter an Israeli ground incursion into Gaza using Hezbollah and the normal means. But the US is now offsetting that Hezbollah and Iranian deterrent, and the Israelis are essentially free to go in as long as they have a plan that looks like it can work.
I want to concentrate on what I know about the Gaza Strip, having been there, having broadcast from there a couple of times over these years. It's a vast rolling sand dune to the south of the city, where the Israelis had farms, had flower gardens, as I recall, and homes. And I was told years ago, Michael, this might be out of date, that that was where the Hamas put their training camp, put their guerrilla camp in the south. And that would be where the migrants or the refugees from the towers and the camps have moved or parked right now. So there's more than half the Gaza Strip that is not right at this moment defended or urban fighting or anything like that. It's open rolling territory. Isn't that available to the IDF to operate out of there as opposed to across the wire in Israel?
Well, the IDF knows that after the October 7th attacks, it needs to attack what they call the center of gravity of Hamas. You know, if you take away a bit of terrain from Hamas in the south, and if you're operating around all of those now displaced person camps, you're getting a lot of the negative aspects of operating in the Gaza Strip, but you're not getting the positive. The positive being to get into the heart of Gaza City, to attack the governing and military infrastructure of Hamas, including tunnel systems, arms caches, leadership locations. But also, Gaza City is a symbol. If the Israelis go in, clear some areas of Gaza City and destroy a great deal of infrastructure under Hamas, then they can say that they have levied a serious cost and made people like Hamas think again about ever doing something like October the 7th, which is why they basically split the Gaza Strip in half and said, all Gaza civilians go south of the Wadi into those more open areas you're talking about, we are going to largely confine ourselves to the north.
Malcolm?
I am interested in your view about the Houthi-launched missiles and drones, which we now learn carried huge payloads and could have done very extensive damage, especially in Eilat, where tens of thousands of those who were evacuated are located. Are the other militias in the region primed to get involved as well? Do you think, beyond Hezbollah and Pij, do you think that they are really prepared to take the risk of engaging and the U.S. response that would inevitably follow?
I think of all of the, quote, axis of resistance, unquote, actors, the Houthis, the Iraqi and Syrian pro-Iran militias, and Lebanese Hezbollah itself, you know, the Lebanese Hezbollah is such a valuable asset to Iran that it doesn't want to spend that asset in this crisis. That's a strategic deterrent system to stop Israel from ever attacking mainland Iran. Instead, they would love retaliatory blows to fall on Syria, and they would love it to fall in Yemen instead. And so the Houthis have demonstrated that they really don't feel like they have a lot to lose by firing a big stream of cruise missiles and drones at Israel. And I think you're absolutely right that they were probably aiming for the Eilat port complexes. Because if you think about it, Ashkelon on the west coast and Haifa, Ashkelon's closed, Haifa is within the war zone. Eilat has become a place that the Israelis have started to depend upon for imports. So I think that was the Houthis trying to do their part for the axis of resistance in that particular location.
Quickly, Michael, what we have here is what appears to be a siege. Siege tactics say it favors the besieger to wait. Is that something that can happen here, wait? And is there a limit to how long the Israelis can wait?
Well, the U.S. seems to be saying to the Israelis, the more effort you put into damage limitation and you know, avoiding collateral damage and attending to humanitarian concerns, the longer we will support you in this operation and provide the shield for you against Hezbollah or Iranian involvement. And so that's really what's dictating the timeline, is how much the Israelis can keep down collateral damage from this point onwards.
Malcolm?
If you are facing a non-state terrorist actor, what sort of protocols does Israel have to live by in terms of the context you just referenced? And I mean, it's clearly different than state-to-state war conflict.
We have about 30 seconds, Michael. Go ahead.
In any kind of warfare, whether the enemy is a state or a non-state actor, your responsibilities towards the protection of civilians is the same.
Michael Knights is the Jill and Jay Bernstein Fellow at the Washington Institute, observing the total fog of war that has descended in the Mideast. Malcolm Hohenlein, Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations. I'm John Batch.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor,